short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilty of all the lies.
Oh, welcome back to the Cold War, episode 218, subtitle Shut the Fuck Up, Scotty B.
My favorite title.
He's been complaining that we haven't put out a Cold War episode. So look, we're recording this on the 14th of July, 2022. I'm in LA, my last day, well, really my second last day in the United States. We fly out tomorrow. Thank fuck. I've had a great time, but it's a long time. A month is a long time to be on the road with your family. Anyway,
amongst Americans,
And so Ray and I were in the Grand Canyon. I don't know when it happened. At some point in the last month, we're in the Grand Canyon for a few days.
Yes.
And look, the plan was we were going to sit down when we were in the Grand Canyon and record some episodes. We did manage to get a Renaissance episode done, but then it was just too crazy. We're not going to go into all the dramas that happened when we were in the Grand Canyon because, you know, lives were ruined, reputations were destroyed, assholes were stretched. So then anyway, I said to Ray in the Grand Canyon, look, if we don't get it done here, don't worry about it. We'll do it. We'll just do it next week when I'm in Utah or
piece
wherever.
Of cake.
But then of course, you caught COVID, Ray.
Right. It took me a while, but I finally got it off my bucket list.
And you got a big dose.
Oh, I got it. I got it.
And
deep.
You caught COVID.
Mm. His name was COVID and it turns out he had COVID. I got it. And because I'm a loving person, I shared it with all my family. All eight of us within a matter of days had it. So you're welcome.
And you're still recovering.
I'm still. I know that me at 100% is not that impressive. I get that. I've been used to it for years. Heather, I mean, pray for her. But the point is, I'm not even 100%. I'm about 85%. So if you could all lower your expectations of me this time. I think we'd all get along fine.
Wow. That's saying something. I also caught COVID.
Yeah. Well, the tongue action.
I initially had assumed we caught it from you guys or we all caught it from the same source because we came down with symptoms, a few days after you reported having it. But current theory is that, in fact, we caught it separately from Chrissy's family in Utah. You know, good Mormons.
Introduction.
First night in Cedar City, Chrissy's hometown. We dropped Fox off with one of her cousins who's got 28 kids because we had to go to Chrissy's school reunion. And then we found out later that one of their kids had COVID and they just didn't bother to tell us. And Fox played with that kid all night. Then Chrissy went in and picked him up, etc., etc. Mind you, before the school reunion, we're at a family reunion where there was 4,000 people, nobody was wearing masks there either. No one was wearing masks at the school reunion, and Utah has the sixth highest number of cases per capita in the United States at the moment, so not surprising. Anyway, we got over it in like a day and a half.
Yeah,
and I got to tell you, the best day. Chrissy was already sort of over it symptoms wise. She still tested positive this morning, like a week later. But she's got a bit of a cough. But after about a day and a half, Chrissy got over the symptoms and she went out wearing a mask. This is before has she tested positive? Yes, she was going to catch up with her family in a park. Distancing,
responsible.
We're in Salt Lake City at this stage by the time this happened. We didn't test positive till we're leaving Cedar City. Anyway, she left me in the Airbnb by myself, and so I had nothing to do for the day. I was feeling not too bad, like a cough, bit congested-y, you know, running a fever, but, you know, it's not too bad.
Right.
Anyway, I thought this was my one opportunity, so I got really fucking baked. And listened to David Bowie's Scary Monsters album with my AirPods on. I got to tell you, it was the greatest day. It was like my worst day of COVID. Right. And I had the best day because I just got really high.
Turning negative.
Listening to Scary Monsters album with headphones on when you're high, so great. Like, it explodes into this 360 degree symphonic thing. I can hear minor, you know, tracks that I've never noticed before, and they're all popping out, and orgasmic. Yes. Just an orgasmic experience. It was the greatest thing.
Right.
No responsibilities, nothing to do, lying in bed, might as well get high and listen to Bowie.
A podcast. I can almost match that. Day two of after I tested positive, it was bad. And I was saying somewhere else, this is not political. Do whatever you got to do to not get COVID, because it stripped me of everything, every little tiny ounce of energy, every layer of defense, every bad decision I've ever made in my life, going back to age 8. I mean, it literally takes everything from you, and you go on this roller coaster ride and you can't do anything to protect. I know this sounds weird, but the point is, imagine being stripped of every bit of defense and rehashing your mistakes. You know what? I should have put on Bowie. I see that now.
Yeah.
I made a huge mistake, but it snuck up on me. I had a high temperature. I was delirious. I was so messed up. I didn't know that I was messed up. And I went through my life, and it was intense. Some good, some bad. Try not to get COVID. Just get high instead.
There you go. Wisdom from Ray. All right, let's get on to the show. So look, our plan for these shows.
Yes.
Because I was traveling, Ray was traveling, we didn't have an opportunity to prepare for stuff like we would normally do. With the shows that we were doing in my US trip, I said, let's do like summary shows.
Yeah.
Let's just talk freely from the heart, from the balls, about what we've done. So we're not going to make a lot of progress here today, I'm sorry to tell you, but we're going to recap everything that we've done. Now, we started this show, the Cold War show, April 2016.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 6 years, six and a bit years ago, we started the Cold War show. We started with mini biographies on Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin. Then we did some episodes on economics, socialism versus capitalism. Then we started on the Yalta Conference, which took place in 1945.
Right.
6 years later, we're up to the Korean War, 1950. Right. So it's taken us 6 years to cover 5 years of actual events.
Uh-huh. Right.
Now we've jumped in and out and gone through this and that and a bit and the other. We've gone back in time a bit to cover things like, you know, the Vietnam, you know, the history of Vietnam and the Vietnam War and that kind of stuff. But 6 years to cover 5 years of timeline. It's almost like we're doing it in real time. So,
right,
you're the events of 1991, the official end of the Cold War, even though we started our series by saying, did it really end? We don't think so.
Right.
And I think subsequent events have proven us correct.
Absolutely.
We're, you know, now, you know, with US and Russia and China all at it again, you know, it's all still going on. We predicted that it wasn't over, and in fact, it's not. But the events of 1991, you know, the end of the bringing down of the Berlin Wall in 89, and then 91, the sort of dissolution of the USSR, took place 46 years after 1945. So we started in 2016. If we do it in real time, 46 years from now, 2061, I think we might be finishing the series, if we're lucky.
Right. There'll be light at the end of the tunnel.
Exactly. Well, that's if we finish in 1991. Of course, you know, the events in the next 46 years or 40 years, we may have to keep going and to talk about real-time events. So 1961, I will be 91. Don't know how old you'll be.
96.
96.
95, something like that. So what you're saying is I need to keep my calendar open for a while. That's what I'm hearing. All right.
That's it.
Just
don't make any plans.
And any of you listeners don't either. Okay. We're going deep.
We started with this quote from Daniel Ellsberg, the guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers, right, one of the real Cold War warriors. He was 84 years old when we started. He'd be 90 now, about the same age I'll be when we finish the show. The quote I started with was, "The understanding of the Cold War that 99 out of 100 Americans hold right now is a fairy tale."
Yes.
Now, you were an American when we started this, Ray. I'm not sure what your affiliation is now.
Internationalist/Portuguese. Go ahead.
I feel like, tell me if I'm wrong, I feel like your view of America has changed in the 6 years we've been doing this show. Am I right in my assessment?
Yeah. I'll just say this real quick and then you can go on. I don't mean to interrupt your flow, but when the World War II ended and the Cold War started, I think a lot of the people in position, the people in the room, if you will, to borrow from Hamilton, knew that this was about economics. There was a degree of the 1930s influence from the preachers about, you know what, all communists are evil. But the point is, so they kind of knew what they were doing going in. By the time I'm born in 1966, the message is down pat. Communists are evil. They literally deserve no mercy. They are atheists. They deserve whatever they get. And we should wipe them out with an atomic or nuclear bomb. I mean, they deserve it because they're that evil. That was the message that I got. There was no questions. There were no filters. There were no opposing sides like they're recommending doing today in history books. It was all just, we're right, they're wrong. And it was absolute. And it took me decades to even question the very basis of that idea. And then you come along with your Miley Cyrus wrecking ball between my testicles and wreck what I had held in my head for decades. And so, yes, my view on the Cold War and America and our foreign policy has changed just a bit, just this much. My fingers are very close together, this much. So we might have been wrong a couple times. I'm done.
Yeah. You know, and when I say that the Cold War is still going on, like the thing that never ceases to amaze me is mm-hmm. when I read news coverage coming out of the United States, but Australia is not much better, about Russia's actions today, about China's actions today. The way that it's painted is very black and white. It's always they're evil. They're intent on world domination. There's no nuance. There's no complexity. There's no explanation of cause and effect. There's no understanding of cause and effect. No, you know, so it's
as is.
It's Cold War mentality. And I see this coming out of Americans as well as in the media. And of course, most Americans, most people in Australia get their views on world events from the media. So if the media is taking a very black and white, good versus evil approach to covering the stories, then it makes sense that most people would have the same sort of interpretation of events. And right. It's this fairy tale that Daniel Ellsberg mentioned. It's true of most Americans' understanding of the Cold War. It's also true of most Americans' understanding of global events today, I think. Although, absolutely. Look, I have been surprised a couple of times. I've been impressed in this trip a couple of times.
Yeah.
Went out to dinner with one of Chrissy's cousins. Great guy. He's actually the founder of and CEO of MemberPress, the software that we use to run our subscriptions on the back of this show and all of our other shows. Right. great guy, Blair. Anyway, and I was talking to him over dinner about Americans believing the propaganda, and he said, "Well, like what? Give me an example." I said, "Well, let me ask you a question. What's your understanding of the reasons for what's going on in Ukraine at the moment?" And he said, NATO expansion. And I was like, oh, fuck, okay, well, you got me there.
Right, I wasn't expecting that one.
And as far as I know, last time we talked politics, he's sort of a Trump supporter, you know, right-wing GOP kind of guy. So I was like, oh, okay. So it might be that they have a better understanding of it than the left in this country. Mm-hmm. Also, his brother, or one of his brothers, who I like, great guy, I was talking with him and his wife, and his wife's a school teacher, and I said, remind me what you teach, and she said Cold War, history. I said, excited. Like, what? She goes, oh, with Cold War stuff. I was like, really? And and I asked her, you know, what she teaches, and, you know, she gave me a really good sort of summary on some of the problems with American understanding of Cold War. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, shit, that's great. But she said, but, you know, we have to cover all of this in like two lessons. So, we don't get into, we don't have the opportunity to get into the complexities of it. But she was very well aware of the sort of the Christianization of America as a tool to fight communism, that kind of stuff. And then at Chrissy's school reunion, I got talking with some people there. There's this one couple, and I think the husband had actually been to Australia on his mission. You know, Mormons go and do a mission when they're like 18. He'd been to Australia. This is decades ago, his mission. But he and his wife had traveled a lot. And I was like talking to Americans who have traveled a lot, because I think gives them a different perspective if they get out of the bubble for a while. Yes. And I said, you know, based on all your traveling, what do you think the perspective is of Americans around the world? And he said, yeah, it's not good. And deservedly so. We've done a lot of really bad shit. So
we've earned it.
So, you know, I've been pleasantly surprised in some of my conversations with Americans. But generally speaking, you know, judging by what I see on Facebook, the general majority still have this black and white view of things like Russia and China and that kind of stuff today. Speaking of black and white, Chrissy and I were watching last night a movie recommended to me by Hunter, my son. It's an Indian movie called RRR, three letter R's. It stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt, I think. Set in sort of, I think, the 1920s in India, colonial India, the British Raj. Mm. And it's about these two guys who are based on two real characters who were revolutionaries against the Raj.
Mm-hmm.
But in this film, they're depicted as basically superhero badasses who literally are built like Schwarzenegger in his prime. These guys are fucking like super, super ripped, but then they can do amazing dance sequences as well. Like
that's important.
It's an action movie in heart. They're fighting tigers and fighting the Raj and fighting each other and it's fantastic, but then they break into a dance sequence. It's terrific.
You got to celebrate.
I know. And it's great. But the depiction of the British in it is very black and white and evil. Which, you know, it's interesting. It's the same as the Chinese film, The Battle of Lake Changjiang, that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested to see these really big budget, glossy, highly produced films coming out of China and India at the moment that depict the West as blatantly evil, black and white, but from their perspective, you know, the West is the black, they're the white. The same sort of propaganda that, you know, we've seen in most Hollywood films since, you know, forever. But now they're doing their own version of Hollywood propaganda coming out of Bollywood and China. I don't know what China's China Chollywood, probably Chollywood. I think it's what we call
Chinwood. I don't. It feels wrong.
That sounds like wrong. A Bruce Campbell documentary. Chinwood. His autobiography was if this chin could talk. I think. Anyway,
but would you? I was just going to say, so when they do what we did back then, even though they're doing it today, their depiction is probably more accurate. Yes, it's over the top, but the British went in there and said, this is ours. We now rule it. We're going to have clubs in your country where your own people can't come in. It's only meant for Brits. So yeah, pretty fucking bad. Whereas we were just kind of pulling shit out of our ass because we didn't want the American people to start going, oh, maybe communism's not the worst thing in the world. So yeah, they're doing it too, but at least theirs is probably a bit more accurate than our propaganda back in the 40s and 50s.
And the 80s and the 90s. Like the depiction of, you know, in every Lethal Weapon movie or Bond movie or whatever movie, you know, your Russians, you know, your
Asians,
evil, evil guys, just straight up negative depictions. Anyway, so we started with the Daniel Ellsberg quote, and then we did the biographies. We got into the bomb was the first. Oh,
there was a bomb, wasn't
after
there?
Yalta. After we did Yalta for, and I'm thinking it's been so long since we've done Yalta, people might have forgotten. So maybe we should just recap.
Bring up those 75 pages of notes and
the 27 episodes we did on Yalta, but. I remember we did make the point, we justified all of the episodes we did on Yalta by saying it all starts here, really.
Yes.
And I think that has proven to be true. I think that the problems that Churchill, FDR, and the West had with Stalin really emanated out of Yalta. Like, we were all buddies, defeated the Nazis, we're going to join up to defeat the Japanese. But then at Yalta, the inability for them to nail Stalin down on
specifics
regarding particularly Germany, a little bit of Poland, how it was going to look.
Why should he?
Exactly. From his perspective, we will come to this at a later time. We'll get we will get to it. Let's not...
broad strokes. Broad strokes.
And then, of course, the foreign ministers were supposed to resolve it and never did. I think their frustration with their inability to nail him down on those sorts of things started a chain of events. Now, you know, who's responsible for that? Is a good question. I mean, Stalin, it would seem it was deliberate. He wanted to keep it loosey-goosey because he didn't want to commit to anything. We know from his discussions with his foreign minister and people like that, that that was probably a deliberate strategy on his behalf to keep it loose so he could drive a truck through it later on.
And smart.
Well, it was also smart. Right. It was good negotiating, right? That's what good negotiators do that. So to say that, you know, he was evil because he did that or he took advantage of them. I mean, they ran out of time. You know, they were there for whatever it was, I think 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, Yalta went on. And, you know, it was clever on Stalin's part, but the blowback on that was, of course, they developed the bomb and didn't tell him about it, hid it from him. You know, he and he knew.
There's no trust.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We also did a series on the Cambridge Five early on too. So the lack of trust between the great powers, you know, had always been there. I mean, they obviously weren't friendly before World War II.
Right.
Churchill had made comments about wanting to kill all of the Jews and the atheists and the communists. And they both invaded Russia, obviously, in 1918, 1919, 1920, you know, to support the royals. But they had forged a bit of a trust basis, particularly Stalin and FDR, I think, had a level of respect for each other and trust for each other. That started to really fracture at Yalta. Then, obviously, FDR died. And I seem to recall that just before he died, he was pounding his fist on the table back in Washington or wherever the fuck he was getting hand jobs from his mistress in the wheelchair, complaining about Stalin not being up front, not being forthright, and you know, trying to slip it in the cracks.
Yeah, he's a politician.
So, yeah, but you know, there is a good argument to be made that when you're in an alliance, when you're in a partnership, you need to give a little. You know that better than anybody. You know,
right.
In a good marriage, you got to give some. You give a little something.
If I understand that, but if I can embody Stalin's anus for a second, I think it would say something like this. Give, bitch, we've given twice to the tune of tens of millions of our people, tens of thousands of villages. You have wiped out our industries. You have wiped, you know, you've taken over where we grow our wheat that feeds the fucking world. We've given, we're not given anymore. This is for you. This is for the tank you rode in on. But no, I mean, yes, Stalin did horrible things, horrible person, yada, 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 yada. But if you just look at it from his point of view, I mean, he's protecting his own. You know what? There's not going to be a third time. Fuck you. I will keep these countries. I will keep my army here. We're not going through this again. Can you blame it? But like you were saying a second ago, because he does things like that, the onus is on him. He gets the label as the bad guy, the guy who breaks up the alliance. It's bullshit. I wanted to ask you this. I really can't see a capitalist country and a communist country working things out to a degree that would be mutually beneficial without some kind of threat like Hitler. And as soon as Hitler's gone, they're going to revert back to norm and they're not going to be able to get along. That's certainly one interpretation of what has happened.
Yeah, and you're right. There was a fundamental distrust on both sides. The mm-hmm. communists legitimately believed and had believed forever that yeah. the Western powers. It's funny. Sorry. So at some point after I left you, we ended up outside of a place called Panguitch in Utah. We were staying at a teepee. Just outside of Panguitch, right. And we're looking. It's near Bryce Canyon. So the first night we were there, we went up and had a look at Bryce Canyon, and then we were looking for somewhere to eat. And I had spotted a place on the road from Panguitch to Bryce Canyon, a little burger joint side of the road. Looked kind of cool, kind of funky, in the middle of nowhere, like just fucking desert everywhere, right? So I thought, let's go back to that place. That looked kind of cool. So we go in, sit down, and this guy about 70 years old comes out, white guy, very sort of worn face, and says, "Hello, you want some food?" And we said, "Yeah." And he goes, "All right." Points at me. I'm getting you a hamburger. Points at Fox. Cheeseburger. Points at Chrissy. Hamburger. Coffees. Yep. Okay. Great. Sit here. No, not there. Sit over here. The wind's too big there. Sit over here. He just takes control, and we were like, great, because we were like exhausted. We're like, fucking yes, that's what I want. Yes,
please tell me.
Somebody take
tell
control.
Me what to do.
Anyway, had a great meal, really good burgers, and he had an accent. I said, "Where are you from?" He goes, "Oh, I've lived here for 50 years, but I'm from Prague, from the Czech Republic." Okay.
Oh, cool.
And he had a big sign up saying freshly baked croissants every morning. I said, "Well, we're going to come back for breakfast tomorrow." He said, "All right." So we went back for breakfast the next day to this place, and really great croissants. We're sitting in the house, and he said, "What are you doing today?" Chrissy said, "Well, Fox and I are going to go hike Bryce Canyon. Cameron's looking for a place to work with Wi-Fi." He goes, "You stay here. You stay with me. I have Wi-Fi. I give you food. I give you Wi-Fi. You stay here. I look after you." I was like, fuck yeah. Okay. His name's Ivo, I-V-O, Ivo. Anyway, end up spending the whole day at Ivo's place. Great conversations. His wife is Swiss. She's great. And then he had a bunch of young guys there, like in their 20s, from Prague, distant mm-hmm. family. They come over for work experience. Right. So he has these guys come over. They do like 6 months, 12 months mm-hmm. work and holiday thing, and then they go back. And they're all chess players, so I end up playing chess with one of these guys a lot. But then Chrissy picked me up about 3:30 and we left, and I said, "We're going to come back for dinner." And he said, "Well, I've got friends coming for dinner at 8 o'clock, so I'm going to do the normal dinner for customers at 6. Can you be back by 6? I said, "Yeah, no problem." So we got back at 6, and he said, "You know what? Fuck it. You just have dinner with us and our friends. Big family dinner." So
right.
He did. We stayed around all night. He cooked for all of these people. Massive family dinner. We're just sitting in the house. He goes, "Next time you come here, you stay in my house. You stay for free." And by the way, this guy's lifestyle, he works 5 months a year, tourist season. Then he shuts up and he travels the world yes. for the rest of the year. He's always done this. Man. And he goes to Australia more often than not, goes to the West Coast, though, Perth, and goes up to Darwin. Okay. So he said when he comes to Australia in February, he's going to come and hang out with us and stay with us, and then we're going to stay with him whenever we're in Panguitch and blah, blah, blah.
Let's go.
Anyway, I end up talking with his young guys while we're playing chess that night after dinner about Cold War history, because they're from the Czech Republic. I said, you know, what do you learn about communism growing up in the Czech Republic? And they were like, well, you know, generally, you know, one of the guys was saying, you know, my parents and my grandparents say, you know, it was much better under communism than it is now. Like, you know, it's really tough now, but under communism, it was good. You know, everyone had a job, everyone got looked after, unless you were the enemy, unless you were the enemy of the state, you know, life was good. Anyway, nice. My point was going to be that what I explained to them was this distrust. Mm-hmm. The communists genuinely believed, and rightfully so, that the West, the capitalists in the West, would not allow communism to succeed anywhere in the world, because if it did, they were worried that the people back home would go, oh, how come those people have all this good shit? And we don't. Now, nice. Here's the irony of that.
Mm-hmm.
They needn't have worried, because, you know, I walk around today in America and say to Americans, you know, back in my country, women have the right to an abortion. Back in my country, everyone gets free healthcare. Back in my country, everyone gets very cheap education. Back in my country, we don't have mass murders, mass shootings every day. Back in my country, it doesn't cost $2 billion to become president. Back in my country. And Americans go, yeah, fuck you in your country. Who gives a fuck what you've got in your country? This is a fucking America. We do it the American way. It doesn't fucking matter what you... Fuck you in your fucking socialist country. We don't care.
Right.
So the capitalists needn't have worried, because Americans don't give a shit, apparently, that people have it better in other countries. They're like, it doesn't matter. It sucks here, but at least it's America.
I'd rather suck here in America than be a happy, successful Australian. Yeah. Fuck you. But that shows how well the programming combined with nationalism has done. I would rather be a poor, suffering, one-legged, one-testicle American than a rich Australian. Yeah, I mean, but you know, but nationalism is a powerful thing, whether using it for good or for bad. It's always powerful. It's always intense. And you got a sampling there of how powerful propaganda can be when mixed with nationalism.
Exactly.
National pride.
They did a very good job. So the communists,
common sense. Fuck common sense. Sorry. Go ahead.
The communists believed that the West would take them down. And the West believed that the communists wanted to take over the world and rape all of their women. And turns out that was just Bill Cosby and Donald Trump.
And some bills.
Yeah.
Right.
The Catholic Church wanted to rape all the children.
Right. Possibly R. Kelly. Go ahead.
Not possibly. He's,
good point.
Been sent to jail guilty for like 20 fun. Years. Yeah.
He's done.
So ideologically, they just didn't trust each other. They had different views, and so they went at it. Now, this gets us to the bomb. So they didn't tell Churchill about. They didn't tell Stalin about the bomb, though he obviously had his spies, the Cambridge Five, that were telling him what was going on. So you had this pre-existing distrust, and then Yalta added to it, and then the bomb added to it. And, you know, everything just kept adding to this distrust, and the propaganda on both sides continued to grow. They're out to get us, the paranoia, the anxiety. I mean, you know, in the West, we always talk about Stalin as being paranoid. But the West was paranoid at equal or greater measure about what the communists were going to do. And we know that, you know, certainly that wasn't their plan at the time. The Russians, the Soviets, Stalin was advocating communism in one country, partly to mollify the West, but also because 20 million people dead, as you said, a country completely
rebuilding,
destroyed, has to rebuild.
Yeah.
It was going to be a long time, a decade, decades before he would be able to do anything much,
right,
in terms of actively promoting communism, etc. But that's where we got to. So then in our series, we talked about the bomb. Now, the recap on the bomb, from my perspective, is that the utilization of it anyway was that there was no real reason to use the bomb on Japan. The Japanese were going to surrender anyway as soon as their peace treaty non-aggression pact with Russia lapsed, which was going to happen in August 1945, from memory. And it was like a couple of days away from happening. Soviet Union was a couple of days away from declaring war on Japan they dropped the bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, because remember, there's this, it was on YouTube, but basically this guy was like saying, you know, if you go back and look at the timeline, the Soviets were about to invade and take some serious ass territory from the Japanese. And they're like, the only thing we could possibly do is surrender and go to the negotiating table and keep some of this. So it was the threat of the Soviets combined with the threat of Americans. But Truman, out of his depth, not a skilled politician, not a worldly politician like FDR, no patience whatsoever. He's acting like a 12-year-old boy. And the bomb was for the benefit of Stalin to, hey, we got this. Don't fuck with us. Even though, as you just said, Stalin had no intention of fucking with anybody, probably for at least 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Truman and his Secretary of State, whose name escapes me. Can you remember his Secretary of State at that point?
The guy that gets replaced by...
Yeah, I didn't ask you who he gets replaced by. I asked you who he is.
Well, that's my path to getting... Fuck you.
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, God, I'm looking right at him. Anyway, sorry, I apologize.
Whatever his name was. You know, they seem to have made the decision to use the bomb. It kind of left it up to then the Air Force to drop it, make the decisions about targets and that kind of stuff. But... they right. gave it the green light, despite the misgivings of a lot of senior military, scientific, civilian advisors. They used it anyway and then seemed to have partially regretted it. I think Truman regretted it, is my take on it. Mm-hmm. After he saw what it did, he was like, oh, fuck, I don't want that on my conscience. Yeah. He justified it, though, for the rest of his life. But
he had to.
Yes, but my sense is that he, you know, he certainly didn't want to use it again. And, you know, as we haven't even got up to this in the Korean War yet, but obviously stopped MacArthur from using it when he wanted to drop it on China.
Right, yeah.
So the bomb was, the bomb was obviously a major turning point in the Cold War because...
yeah.
They did.
It heightened everything.
They dangled it in front of the Soviets as a threat.
Yes.
So they started, you know, it was an implicit and implied threat against the Soviet Union that, yes, you know, look at us the wrong way and we'll drop some of these fucking things on you. And the Soviets didn't know how many of them they had. They could add 100 or 1,000. They had none after they used them both, but the Soviets didn't know that. And of course, then they, you know, were building their own bomb, which they finally finished a few years later. And of course, that started to change the dynamic of the Cold War as well, once they had the bomb as well.
But let me just ask you quick. You have two sides who are opposing, but they're still ramping up in their opposition. And suddenly one side goes, you know what? I literally have the capability of destroying every major city in your country, not just burning it. I can literally wipe it out and wipe out all your people. I mean, any sense of communications or even a chance at any kind of beginning of trust or whatever goes right out the window, because literally one side is holding all the cards. Why should they negotiate? And then why should the weaker side trust them? I mean, this literally was the beginning of so many missteps, miscommunications, lack of trust, and it just built from there, which is sad enough, but you're talking about nuclear weapons added to the mix. I mean, I think we said this before, it's kind of amazing we're all still sitting here.
Yeah. So we had the bomb, then we talked about Castro, because Castro died in there, and we did mm-hmm. a couple of episodes on Castro. We still haven't got to the Cuban Revolution, but hopefully somewhere in the next 40 years we'll get to that.
Definitely, probably.
Then we did Vietnam. We started on the Ho Chi Minh Vietnam series.
Amazing, amazing man.
Do you want to do a quick recap of that story?
I'm just trying to come up with another example of someone who was willing to devote their entire life to the independence of their country. And like you said, he said, I will work with anyone. So basically, yeah, it's just another country that's ruled by the Europeans. They're taking all the resources out. Everybody suffers in the country. He comes along. He's well-read. He's well-traveling. He's like, there's got to be a better way. We've got to be able to rule ourselves. Travels all over Europe, goes to America. Cannot get anyone to help him with this problem because basically they're not important enough. Maybe if there was a whole bunch of oil there, America would have done something. But the point is, he was never ever to get any help. So he had to do a lot of it on his own, but he was willing to not waste. He was willing to take his entire life to achieve this. Just one of those leaders that is very rare and is so whatever the opposite of self-centered is. Selfish. This man was just willing to devote
selfless.
He was willing to devote everything about his life to this cause. Very few of us can honestly say that or match that.
Yeah. Yeah. In my mind, Ho Chi Minh is fucking Jesus, man.
Like, yes.
but better than Jesus. Yeah. Because A, he did it for 50 years, and B,
right.
He's real.
And there's an idea. Fictional, and he's also dark-skinned character. Like Jesus, but that's a whole nother.
Like Jesus.
Sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, from I think about 1919, the Paris Peace Conference, when I think he was about 19.
Right.
Or 20, 21, something like that. You know, he went to Paris, tried to get a petition to Woodrow Wilson to say, please help us get rid of the French. Wilson gave him double fingers up. And that was it. So he looked around. Well, the Americans don't give a shit. Who might give a shit? Oh, the communists have just taken power in Russia, and they're talking about freedom for all oppressed peoples.
That's how you do it.
So started to align himself with the Marxists. But even then, in World War II, when he was back in his country after being in exile for decades,
right,
trying to get rid of the Japanese out of the country, you know, approached the OSS, forerunner to the CIA, and they liked him.
Oh, yeah.
They were like, the guys that dealt with him, they were like, yeah, this guy, we can work with this guy. He's a good guy.
Good people.
He's happy to work with us. He's happy to join our club. If we support him in first getting rid of the Japanese and then secondly keeping the French out,
right.
And the Americans were like, fuck him. Who does he think he is? We do whatever the fuck we want.
Right.
Now, from the American perspective, getting rid of the Japanese was all good. But the French, you know, going back to after World War One and after World War Two, even though the Americans and the British hate the French, they kind of need the French to act as a buffer to Germany and also then the Soviet Union. So, yeah, they were like, on one hand, freedom of all peoples. On the other hand, we kind of need the French. So, fuck freedom of all people for all peoples.
Right.
We'll just keep the colonialism going when it's convenient. You know, it's...
Yes.
Because, again, and look, this is the, you know, this is the basic truths of all of this that we've been talking about in the Cold War show. It's not about right versus wrong. It never has been. It's not about good versus evil. It's about my strategic interests versus your strategic interests. That's what it's always been about, what it's always will be about. Yes. Where what's important to me is my strategic interests. It's not, we wrap it up with bows and ribbons and we say freedom and democracy and liberty and all this kind of bullshit. Yeah. But at the end of the day, what it's really about is my strategic interests versus your strategic interests, my economic interests versus your economic. And my strategic interests are just about protecting my economic interests, let's be honest. That's and my safety, which is also my economic interest because life has a value. It's all about protecting my economic interests. And by mine, I don't mean the entire country, really. I literally mean me and a handful of handful of my friends, rich white guys who are my campaign supporters.
The best lads, the best bunch of boys. Anyway, we run the country.
So yeah, Ho Chi Minh then dedicated his entire life first of getting rid of the French, then getting rid of the Japanese, then getting rid of the French again, and then getting rid of the Americans. And he died in his 70s, a couple of years before the Vietnam War officially ended. Dedicated his entire adult life to a cause, the freedom and independence of his people. Absolutely, you know, fucking monumental. Like I cannot even begin to get into the mind space of a guy like Ho Chi Minh, and he should be revered. He should be should be treated the same way that Gandhi or Nelson Mandela or
JFK,
Vaclav Havel, Martin Luther King. He should be idolized by people around the world as one of the great leaders of a nation who fought, gave his entire life to fight for the freedom and independence and liberty of his people. If we really cared about freedom and liberty, we'd be honoring people like Ho Chi Minh in the West.
But we're not. We're interested in our liberty, our freedom, and our bottom line. Fuck everybody else. But you're right.
And I'd have to say, like, you know, you could also make the same argument for Hitler, that he gave his adult life for the freedom and independence and liberty of his people. Not that they were occupied, but they were, you know, after World War One, the humbled, reparations placed upon them.
Yes.
You know, by the...
Yeah. You like to say what you want about Hitler, but he killed Hitler. There's another part, say what you want about Hitler, but he did his part to end colonialism, because after World War II, people are going, you know what? It's kind of hard to justify this out in the open. So it starts stripping the British Empire, yada, yada, yada. But the point is, I think you should get some credit for that. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. He defeated the British Empire.
Two good things. He killed Hitler and he defeated the British Empire. Mm. So.
And he gave us the Volkswagen and Autobahns.
Mm-hmm.
So, and rockets, you know, lots of good things that Hitler did. Yeah. Yeah. He wouldn't have landed man on the moon. We wouldn't have James Webb telescope sending back pretty images of the stars if it wasn't for Hitler.
Right.
Let's all remember that today. Yeah, thank you, Hitler. Every time somebody posts a James Webb photo, I'm going to go, thank you, Hitler.
That's Hitler. Operation Paperclip. And just the whole thing. Oh, my God. We're going to hell.
So the Ho Chi Minh, I really enjoyed. And we have to go back and finish the Vietnam War series at some point.
Within 40 years. Yeah.
Super impressed by what we learned about Ho Chi Minh. Yeah. Then we did the HUAC. The Al Pacino episode. The House Un-American and Committee and the Red Scares and the Christianization of America.
That's right.
Where we talked about guys like Father Coughlin, the firebrand Catholic priest who dominated the radio airwaves in the 30s, hated Roosevelt, called him Franklin Rosenfeld, which was actually the family's original name. So, but you know, he was a Catholic priest, and he was an interesting character, I recall, because he was all about communist ideals. social reform, you know, ending the wealth disparity or doing something about the wealth disparity, taking down the rich elite, you know, welfare for the common man. But at the same time, massive anti-communist, hated the communists, just believed in everything that they wanted. Like, I love everything about communism except
but
the communists. I don't like the communists.
I won't wear the uniform. No, I love what they do, but I will not be strapping on a tunic and boots anytime soon. Yeah.
Which, you know, as we pointed out in the series, like the sort of social and economic reform that Coughlin was arguing for was pretty common of Christians in the early 20th century. Even FDR came from some denomination, can't remember which one it was, but they were big into social economic welfare reform.
Right.
Which probably has a lot to do with what he ended up doing.
Mm-hmm.
But Coughlin hated Roosevelt, which is interesting. He was an anti-Semite, Coughlin.
Sure.
Of course, well, he's a Catholic, so it goes without saying.
Exactly.
And again, most Americans were anti-Semites in the 30s. Most of the people in the world, most people in the world outside of the Jews were anti-Semites.
Yeah.
And even some of the Jews were anti-Semites.
That's how bad it was.
Everyone hated the Jews. You know, famously, you know, in 1941, I think the Evian Conference that Roosevelt pulled together but didn't attend because he was getting a blowjob from his mistress that was scheduled weeks in advance. He couldn't cancel it.
You can't. You don't cancel those.
No. Fuck no. He, yeah, the Evian Conference, I remember, the purpose of which, to remind people, was to figure out what they were going to do with the Jews. Hitler didn't want them.
Right.
And,
take them.
Hitler had said, take them. Not only will I send them anywhere you'll have them, I'll pay the transport. I'll pay to put them on the boats. I'll ship them.
Pay to play.
We won't even put gas chambers on the boats. You know, we'll leave that to you to worry about when you get them.
Keep the gas.
Build your own gas chambers.
Why do I get to do your work for you?
I don't have to. I don't have to build your gas chambers.
I'm busy here with my Third Reich. Anyway.
So. And I remember the Australian foreign minister at the time, whose name was hilariously Mr. White, said, we don't have a racial problem in Australia and we don't intend on importing one, or something to that effect.
Which
the Australian Aboriginals said, hello.
That's right.
And can we, by the way, and he's like, shut up. We don't even consider you as humans.
Right.
You don't even have the fucking vote. Fuck off.
La, 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 la.
So... you know, all of that happened. But the Red Scare, so that we had Father Coughlin. He didn't really work out as the leader of the Christianization of America. So they got this guy, Fifield. I should go to his fucking church while I'm here. My last day or two in LA, I should go check out his church because that's where it all started, right?
Right.
So he became the pastor of this massive church in LA, and then he started preaching capitalism and Jesus and America and Christianity all go together, and everything else is evil and you need to shun it. Now, of course, part of the campaigning to get him, and then eventually most of the pastors and preachers and priests in America on board with this campaign, was the knowledge that communism was anti-religion and pro-atheism. It saw religion as a tool of the oppression of the masses.
Right.
And, you know, the 150 million women in America who just lost the right to an abortion because of the Christians and the Supreme Court might agree with us now that it's a tool of the oppression of the people.
I think so.
But so the priests and the pastors and the preachers, the three Ps, had incentives to demonize communism because it was a threat to their jobs and their beliefs, I guess, too. They thought, well, if it comes here, people will become atheists. Now, you know, the irony of that is, of course, here we are 60, 70 years later, Everyone's becoming an atheist anyway, because of the internet and science and shit like that. I don't think it's true here, but in Australia now, no religion is the largest choice in the census when they took the last census.
Wow, that's progress.
In terms of your religious affiliation, no religion was the largest. I think Christianity or maybe Catholicism came second. I think it's Catholicism. If you add up all of the Christian denominations, it's still bigger than the atheists. But in terms of, you know,
individual
particular
parties.
Denomination, no religion came first. I know it's growing here too. It's up around 15, 17, 20%. I can't remember what the latest numbers are. Pew poll in the US.
Would you say that the child molestations had anything to do with it?
I think a little bit. Yeah, I think some people have left the Catholic Church over that. We ran into a couple of Mormons in Chrissy's old hometown, or ex-Mormons, FOMOs,
right?
Who have left the LDS Church in recent years over their treatment of LGBTQ people. We met one woman who's got a couple of queer kids, and she said, "I just couldn't be part of it anymore." You know, their treatment of my queer children. There's a lot of these things that are driving people out.
Right. But again, I can't let this go by. Because I get so few zingers in there. What do you call a gathering of priests? A molestation. Very proud of that. There's a coffee mug. Anyway, please continue.
Is that yours?
Yes.
You come up with that?
That's an Array original. Ray original.
Wow, that's very good. I like
that. I might have been high at the time.
We should get that on a coffee mug.
Send it to my brother-in-law, Eric.
Yeah, I'll give it to all the Catholics that I know.
There you go.
So Fifield then put together this campaign, the spiritual mobilization campaign, where basically they said to the preachers around the country, get on board and get free money. And they did.
Yeah,
and so the capitalists would sink money into the churches of the guys that were, speaking out about the evils of communism. Obviously, it's in the capitalists' best interest to demonize communism.
Yes.
And that's when you started to get, In God We Trust on your coins, as in the 50s, presidential prayer days, meetings, and all this kind of bullshit.
1952, I think, was the first one. Mm. Something like that. Yeah.
And then, of course, and I had to tell my cousin-in-law, about the flag. I said, hey, you know where the flag came from? And she knew about the guy selling flags and the Pledge of Allegiance and all of that kind of stuff. She didn't know that the American... I said, do you know who designed the American flag? And they were like, yeah, it was whatever her name is, Mary Steenburgen. Betsy Ross. Yeah. I go, nah. She just stole the British East India Company's flag. It was that old Betsy Ross thing is bullshit. It was the British East India Company's flag. You just went, fuck it, we'll just take that one.
Works.
The world's second corporation. We'll take their flag and use it for the nation of the corporation.
How apropos. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So that was the Christianization of America. Then we did the Berlin Blockade, 1948.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember what started the Berlin Blockade, Ray, how that came to be?
Were the Westerners going to flood it with a whole bunch of money, or am I thinking of something else? I can't remember.
Yeah, that was part of it. So 1947, the US, the UK, and the French declared they were going to merge their zones into Trizonia.
Right.
It was going to be Bizonia, the US and the UK. The French weren't happy about the idea of merged West Berlin, and then they finally gave in, so it became Trizonia.
Right.
Now, there was the Allied Control Commission, where those three and the Russians were all supposed to sit down and agree on anything that happened in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the US, the UK, and the French just decided to do this without the Russians. They just decided to press ahead.
Right.
The Russian foreign minister walked out of the Allied Control Commission, never to return, and it was never to meet again. And then in 48, in Trizonia, they decided to press ahead with economic reforms, again, ignoring the Russians.
Yeah.
They were going to flood it with money. They were going to do all sorts of stuff. And so Stalin said, no, fuck you.
Yeah.
And he tried to block supply of West Berlin, because they had to go through East Berlin to get to West Berlin. And then they had the airlift and all of that kind of stuff that came with it. So again, you know, you've got this growing distrust. And at this point, it's gone from distrust into straight up conflict.
Yes, right? Antagonism. Yes.
There was a pilot, American pilot, I think, I recall, said something about how on the seventh day the Lord made he created the universe, and then on the eighth day he created the Berlin airlift to convince pilots not to want to fly airplanes or something like that. It was dicey shit. It was an amazing feat, the Berlin airlift. But, you know, again, in the West, the Russians get blamed for the blockade. Really, if you drill down into it, cause and effect.
They were responding.
The Trizonians were doing shit without the Russians. Now, of course, the reason they were doing that is because the Russians wouldn't agree on anything that they wanted to do. This is, again, comes from Yalta. Right?
Yes.
Because none of this stuff was nailed down in Yalta. The Russians were like, what's the hurry? We just do what we'll think. We'll talk about it next week, my friends.
Later. Yes.
Now, of course, the Russians' concerns were that they didn't want to see the West, they didn't want to see Germany built up into a functioning economy, with a military, for good reasons. You know, Germany had invaded them twice in living memory. And they didn't trust the Germans, whereas the US, the UK, and the French did want to build up West Germany into an economic and military powerhouse.
Yes,
to use as a buffer against Russia.
Yeah.
So you know, there was blame on both sides. Plenty of blame. Good people on all sides, as Donald Trump said later on. Distrust driving all parties. The Russians distrusted the West's motives in Germany.
Yeah.
The West distrusted Russia, full stop. And so it ended up in the Berlin blockade, which just made things far worse. And that was that was the end. This is, 1948. This is sort of the end of any semblance of...
Oh, yeah.
Friendship and alliance, I think, between the East and the West.
Stalin had made his line in Eastern Europe. He made it quite clear that he wasn't going to give anything up to the Americans. That is anathema, because we want to be able to sell into those markets so we don't have another economic depression. But it gets wrapped up in patriotism and freedom and liberty and all that other shit. And that's taken us decades to even begin to unravel that. That's how powerful and effective this message was.
Yeah. So then we did a series on Israel, the creation of Israel, which sort of happened around this period as well, the late 40s. Yeah.
I didn't realize
tell me more.
I didn't realize, maybe I should have, but I didn't realize they pretty much just busted up in there. I thought maybe this was an international agreement, but basically the certain segment of Jews were like, nope, we're going in hard, we're going in blazing, we're going to take shit, we're not going to give any jobs to the locals, so they have to move out, we're going to buy up their land as we can, and we're not ever going to back down. And so they wonder why that segment of the world hates them, because they pretty much just came in there and took over.
Yeah. And, you know, it's important to remember that from the perspective of the local inhabitants, the Palestinians, and, you know, the Turks that controlled it in the early part of the 20th century before World War One, You know, it was when we say the like the Jews were coming in and taking land, most of them were Russian communists. So they right. were European. They were these were white skinned, light skinned,
yeah.
You know, from the European, mostly
Caucasian.
Mostly Russian. Right. Little bit of smattering of people from other parts of Europe, some German Jews, some French Jews,
white,
mostly Russians coming in, and you know, basically colonialism from the viewpoint of the locals. These are Europeans coming in. They just got rid of the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
Then they got taken over by the British and the French anyway.
Thanks.
And supposedly just temporarily. Right. Then they have these mostly Russian Jews coming in.
Yes.
And taking over. And so, yes, it was an aggressive maneuver on behalf of the Jews who came in. We know this because their letters to each other have survived and have been reported
right.
by some authors, historians, journalists. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I think we said this in the series. Do I empathize with the desire of the Jews to have their own country? Yeah, absolutely. They've been treated like shit for thousands of years, particularly by the Christians all around the world of any denomination. Everyone hated the Jews because they killed Jesus.
Right.
And also because they're a little bit up themselves, to be honest.
Yeah,
you know, this whole we're the chosen ones.
Right.
Yeah, we're the chosen ones. God made a pact with us. Fuck you. It's always going to rub people up the wrong way.
How can it not? Yes.
Yeah. So, so it's a bit like the Mormons, right? The Mormons have the same thing. I mean, all religions have the same thing, and the Americans have the same thing.
We're the best.
But this, the whole, like, we're the chosen people, and you can all just fuck off. That attitude is never a good one. The only people who can get away with that, quite frankly, are history podcasters like us. Like because we are the chosen ones. Let's face it.
Yes.
Listen, and if you're sitting there and you're like, oh, you guys are shit. Listen, let me remind you of something. We don't have jobs, motherfuckers. We don't have jobs. We sit around and get high all day. Well, Ray does. I work. Ray gets high. We sit around, we travel the world.
It's a partnership. Right.
we don't have jobs. Yeah. So who's laughing now? Hey,
Not just anybody could do this. Yes, I hear what you're saying. We don't even do it very well. That may be true, but no one's stopping us, and we're going to keep doing it. So.
I said to a couple of Chrissy's nephews and nieces the other day, look, if I'm proof of anything, because they're talking about jobs and you know, somebody, just, one of them just got fired, let go from their job. And I'm like, jobs are for losers. Like, honestly. I said,
your own job.
If I'm proof of anything, it's that anybody, if they can find a small enough audience,
right.
a small audience of loyal, cool mm-hmm. people. Yeah, you can make a living from doing whatever the fuck you want. Like, there's no excuses.
Yeah.
You don't have to get a job.
You got
to
jump in. Just jump in and do
it. We appreciate you, listeners.
We do.
We do. Most of you, anyway. Some of you.
Scotty
B.
Scotty B.
Jesus Christ. Chrissy said to me, so I was driving here, driving like 7 hours from Cedar City to LA yesterday, and Chrissy's on Facebook. She goes, oh, Scotty B. Once is like going, tell Cameron he owes me some fucking Cold War shows. And I said, like, does he even pay us any fucking money? Last time I checked, he hadn't paid us any money. And I gave him a free account because he was broke. So shut the fuck up, Scotty. Jesus Christ. Anyway, love Scotty.
I miss Fun Scotty.
But also, I said, by the way, tell Scotty I've been in America for a month. In California for some of that. He lives in California. He hasn't come to visit me, so you know, he can get
selfish
fucked, really.
Selfish bastard.
Where was I? Oh, Israel.
Right. Yeah.
So yes, it was a deliberate, forceful, aggressive takeover of this land. I you know, as I was saying before, I feel for them, but you know that doesn't justify taking over a country and pushing the existing inhabitants out.
Or the consequences that come after that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, the Israel, most people in Israel, the Israeli government, if they have such a thing at the moment, it's hard to tell. They still don't acknowledge the crimes and the history that were committed. And if anyone like us mentions them, you immediately get called an anti-Semite. You're just not allowed to talk about it.
Right.
All this kind of bullshit. It's stupid.
Which, again, shows you how powerful propaganda can be. We can just label you and destroy you because you said something that we didn't like. So, yeah, it's powerful stuff.
Try and cancel us, motherfuckers. yeah.
We'll go out when we decide. Fuck you.
Yeah. Exactly. Fuck you. Then we did a series on Tito. I was sitting at a table in the...
The famous Jackson.
Yeah, I was sitting at a table in the restaurant, in the restaurant in the hotel, having breakfast this morning. There was this family next to us. Guy, I heard them speaking a Slavic language. The guy's covered in tats,
right?
And he looked like Russian mobster. And Chrissy got talking to the wife, and they're from Slovenia.
Oh, cool!
Part of the former
Yugoslavia.
And I was like, "Oh, fucking Tito, he was the greatest." No, I didn't say that. So we did the whole Tito thing. You know, we've only done part of the story. We did the part up to where they took control of the country.
Exactly. Breakaway.
I enjoyed that story. What's your recollections? What's your takeaways about Tito?
Oh, no. Class act. Again, he was influenced by his earlier years, but basically, like Ho Chi Minh, he was in love with this country. He had a plan. He had a loyal team, and he was willing to sacrifice his life, or at least spend his entire life, when not, you know, banging some broad or whatever, but he was willing to give his life for his country to build it up, and then to go the extra step and break away from Stalin. I mean, that's just balls the size of Texas. But again, he was a patriot, which I don't know if that word gets used a lot about him, but it should.
Yeah, well, yeah, he fought against the Nazis, and then as a, you know, once he became the top dog, you know, played this really interesting balancing act, which we haven't finished telling his story, obviously, but was able to stay on relatively friendly terms with the West. The West loved him because he was open to discussion. He wasn't obviously very friendly with Stalin. And of course, the great story that we always remember about Tito is Stalin kept sending people to try and kill him. And Tito wrote him a letter effectively saying, "That's it. Stop now. If you send another one, I'm going to have to retaliate, and I'll only retaliate once." Something to that effect.
I'll only have to send one guy. Yeah,
so I'll have to send one guy. And then Stalin died like 6 months later. So,
Hey, who knows? Yeah. You might have just
uncovered. Who knows?
Something.
Yeah.
History Channel, here we go.
I wonder if Tito ever like took credit for it. If they ever said, "Hey, do you have anything to do with it?" He'd be like, "I'm not saying I did. I'm not saying I did it.
Possible. It's possible." Mm. Yeah.
All I'm saying is look at the timeline.
That's right. Don't fuck with me. Things happen. Things have a tendency to happen to people that fuck with Tito. That's all I'm saying.
So, and of course, part of the whole, so this gets back to sort of what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, but you know, we talked about we'll talk about this in the Bullshit Filter show that we do next, but, you know, we talked about the, in the Tito series, the fascists, right? I think they're the Croatian fascists that were sort of aligned with the Catholics, and they were, oppressing their own people and the Muslims and the whole thing. So Tito was one of these guys where he had to, like a lot of the strong men that we've talked about in the Bullshit Filter, like Assad's father in Syria and guys like that, Saddam. When you have a country that's made up of peoples with a very long and bloody history, not unlike being the president of the United States. When you have Muslims, big Muslim population who hate the Catholics, and the Catholics who hate the Muslims, and Protestants that hate the Catholics, and Catholics that hate the Protestants. And they're all, they've got a long history of killing each other and oppressing each other. And you have to kind of govern a country like that. Very, very difficult to pull off. And of course, as we all know, Tito dies, the country dissolves,
exactly,
and immediately just start killing each other again. So these guys, they were strong men, but probably for a reason. And they had power for a long time,
yes,
but probably for a good reason.
Yeah.
Because it took a guy like that to keep the place from falling apart. Now, maybe that's a justification, but I think it's a bit like when we talk about Stalin and the five-year plans and the famines that came out of that and all this kind of stuff. And you say, well, yes, it was horrible and it was obviously not executed well. But what's the alternative? Like, what would you have done differently if you were in his shoes when you've got a massively growing population that, this is in Stalin's case here, where they're sort of illiterate, missed out on the Industrial Revolution thanks to the Tsars. What are you going to do when you know the West are coming for you and the Germans are coming for you and you've got to catch up really quickly?
Yes.
You got to get your food production in order. You got to get your engineering, your industrialization in your country. Got to catch up. You got to build a huge military. You got a couple of years to get this fucking shit done. You got to move fast. And if the people are illiterate, they're like, what's the hurry? We haven't done it for thousands of years. Why do we have to do it now? You got to go, all right, fuck it, all you guys in a gulag. Shut the fuck up. We got to get this done, right? That was Stalin's viewpoint.
Yeah.
And you may disagree and say it was brutal, but what would you have done differently to get your country? You need to make 100 years worth of progress in 3 years. How are you going to do that?
Yeah. And he's not going to get the benefit of the doubt from the West either way. So it doesn't really matter. They're going to label him a monster either way. But yeah, I mean, he knew what was coming and he needed an industrial base. And you do that by selling wheat because the world needs wheat. He needs money. You're right. It was mismanaged. It could have been a lot better, but he was doing what he thought was right in order to save the country.
Yeah. And so you got Tito, not without his flaws.
But strong man. Speak for themselves. Like you said, a lot of the infighting, he stopped it. And the second he's gone, comes right back. So you got to give him credit for that.
Those tensions in places like that don't go away.
Exactly.
They're probably still there today.
Yes.
Yeah. So then we talked about the creation of the CIA.
I just put something up on the Cold War Facebook page about some brand of pants is using the CIA as their commercial. There's something like, if CIA had pants or if CIA were pants, that's how tough these pants are. I'd never seen anything like that before. So I just threw it up on the Facebook Cold War page to check out. But anyway, they have a reputation for being tough, for being able to get things done, the impossible things. But as we now know, they fucked up more than they did not. They cost tens of thousands of lives. I don't know how many millions or billions or trillions of dollars over the year. Pretty fucked up organization, but somehow their reputation among certain circles stays intact.
I seem to recall there was one line about how, and this is in the 70s, like during the church committee hearings, less than I think a quarter of covert CIA operations in its history up to that point had been approved by a president or any other senior civilian.
So they're just the wild cards on their own, just doing their own fucking thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It was all, a lot of it was black ops, plausible deniability, hidden from the American people and hidden from the American president, hidden from Congress.
You're welcome.
Then, and that must still be true today. I mean, there's this idea that it was all cleaned up after the church committee hearings, Frank Church, but in the 70s, but I don't think anyone really believes that. No one who's, you know, pays attention really believes right. that they're not still doing that kind of shit.
Who's the guy that worked for Trump as an advisor? He had the big giant mustache. He wrote a book.
Bolton.
Do you hear what he said? You probably heard what he said the last 48 hours when he was talking about Trump. He goes, look, I've been in on some coups, some overthrows, not here, obviously, but I've been involved some in my time. This is a coup. But the way he goes, I was in on toppling other governments. That was kind of jams, but I was not involved in this one. I just want to make that absolutely clear. And people are going, you don't say that out loud. Those are the words you don't say out loud.
Yeah, we'll do, talk about that more on the bullshit filter. But yeah, he was on Jake Tapper, and he basically said, said Trump didn't have the brains or the balls to do a coup d'etat in America, January 6th. He said, and I should know because I've been involved in quite a few.
Right.
Not here, mind you.
No.
And then he mentioned Venezuela and the whole Guaido thing. Yeah, that was us. Yeah, we did that. It didn't work. Yeah, it was hard. Harder than it looks.
We came close.
Coups are harder than they look.
That's right. Yeah. CIA.
And of course, at the time, the Trump administration and Bolton were denying any involvement in the coup attempts in Venezuela. Now Bolton's like, it was us. Of course that was us. So, the CIA, like I still believe, I've said this for years, I still believe it's true. The CIA is the world's largest and longest running terrorist organization.
Yes.
Outside of maybe the Catholic Church. It is a terrorist organization, and I mean that genuinely, legitimately, because it is financed and directed,
right?
Sometimes directly and sometimes indirectly, engineered terrorism on a massive scale around the world. Death squads in places in Latin America and South America. Attempts at overthrowing governments and successfully overthrowing governments by creating riots, including, up until 2014 in Ukraine, the overthrow of the government there. We know that the Americans were involved in that. At least we know that they were involved in figuring out who was going to run the country afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Good reason to believe they were involved in supporting and engineering through various CIA fronts the riots and the protests, etc., that happened before. So, this is their job, is to terrorize and overthrow governments. So the CIA is a terrorist organization, I think, by any definition of terrorism, if you understand, the history of the CIA and its current activities.
Right.
And then we got into the Korean War, which we're still technically doing. Do you want to provide a quick summary to the Korean War?
Well, the whole thing started with the necessities of World War II. The Japanese are there. They've been there since, 1910. We got to get them out. They're running the place. But for right now, because we have multiple attack opportunities, let's divide the country in half. The Russians take the north. The rest of the Allies will take the south. And not unlike Yalta, we'll work out the details later. Well, it all falls apart because the South Koreans one thing, the Russians who were there really don't care. They don't care. But Syman Rhee turns out to be a complete asshat, but he's a Christian, so that's okay. He wants it all. Kim in the north has different ideas. And so, again, a lack of communication, a distrust. Everybody's got ambitions, and everybody thinks they're being backed by someone that's powerful. And so you try to bully your way in. And then pretty soon you have a shooting war. Again, no one was willing to listen to the other side or compromise.
Yeah, I'd add to that that the original plan when they divided the country up along the 38th parallel was that it would be unified.
Yeah.
That was after they got rid of the Japanese, it would be unified.
Right.
But of course, by the time that became a possibility, the South wanted to control the whole country. The Americans wanted it to be controlled by an American friendly government. Yes. Even though the Americans knew Syngman Rhee was a piece of shit and they didn't like him.
But he's our piece of shit.
He's our piece of shit, yeah. and the North, Kim, and the Russians wanted the entire country to be unified under a Soviet-friendly government. And neither side was willing to give in or concede. And at this stage, of course, 1950, the late 40s and 50, when it all was, you know, became a shooting match.
Right.
The distrust levels between the West and the East were insurmountable. Yeah. And you had, you know, in that period, in the late 40s, you had George Kennan write his X article about containment, and that sort of gets metastasizes in the US to, you know, we need to throw everything that we have at this. You have the Truman Doctrine. You have the national security, was it 56, whatever the, so 65, 56, can't remember the document that says, that Truman signed off that basically says, we will do whatever it takes to stop the communists from getting one inch of ground. And, you know, we've got to protect our strategic interests around the world. 65, I think, is the number coming into my head. So you end up with this situation in the Korean War early on where nobody can get along. Then it looks like the South are going to attack the North. South certainly wanted to attack the North. The North claimed that the South did attack them first, mm-hmm. and then they retaliated. The South claims that the North started it. The Americans were convinced that Stalin was driving the whole thing, and it was all part of, it was the first step in a worldwide takeover, even though Stalin really had nothing to do with it, didn't really, you know, sort of belatedly said, yeah, look, if you do it, I won't get any way. Because the Americans had said, who was the Secretary of State at the time, this stage? It was... Acheson, I think. Dean Acheson. Had basically given a speech, say, you know, talking about all of America's strategic interests, and Korea wasn't one of them.
Left it out.
So Kim and Stalin saw this as a signal from the US that they didn't really care about South Korea.
Right.
And certainly it had never appeared on any list of strategic interests up until that point. So Stalin said, yeah, okay, I think you got the go-ahead, but don't say it came from me. And then when it happened, the Americans got involved very quickly. They weren't really ready for another conflict because Truman had been demobilizing things.
Yes.
MacArthur came in, had some quick victories, went over the 38th parallel, pushed all the way up to the Yalu River, and then Mao was like, don't come anywhere near the Yalu River. Nope. Don't come near the Yalu River. I'm telling you, don't come near the Yalu River. I'm telling you for the 50th time, don't get anywhere near the Yalu River. They went to the Yalu River. Mao attacked, and then MacArthur went, what? We didn't,
Didn't see that coming?
What were the, what's that?
Gasp.
Complete surprise, shock and surprise. What? How dare they? This is...
Stab in the back, if you ask me. This is crazy. Yeah. All I was going to do is go up to your border and go over and shoot you in the face. And now we're not friends anyway.
Yeah. Take out your power stations and that kind of thing. So so I think that's a quick summary of the Cold War up until this point. 218. We've done 217 episodes over 6+ years.
Yeah.
And that's it in an hour and whatever summary.
So if we can live another 50 years or so, or 60 years, we can lock this thing down. So
Should say to new listeners, look, you don't have to listen to the first 217 episodes. Just start with 218 and pick it up from there.
Right. If you want the cheap short version, but there's a lot of meat. There's a lot of good jokes in there. So maybe
cheap short, aka the Ray version, cheap and short.
Not wrong.
Well, that's the Cold War. I'll be back in America, Australia next week, and we will restart our normal work schedule.
Yes.
And start pushing out some episodes. I don't know what we're doing. Are we still doing Korean War when I get back?
Yeah, we got MacArthur's about to go, no gum, no gum. So we got to get cover of that.
No gum?
Nukem. That was my accent.
Oh, Nukem. Right.
No gum. Right. No gum for you, bastards.
Yeah.
No,
it was...
the Which great is why today...
The great American gum blockade of 1950.
which explains why there's no gum in North Korea today. That's true.
Go to North Korea, you cannot find gum. People complain, there is no gum.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent.